cable, look at all the channels you got. Now, let's just look at the channels for a second. We'll just do it like, because we'll simplify it now. Channel one, you look out at the world, it's all bodies and physical stuff, right? Old, people are old, young, fat, thin, dark, light, bald, hairy, whatever, brunette, blonde. Shift to channel two, psychosocial roles. Mothers, fathers, bus drivers, lawyers, doctors, depressed, manic depressives, schizophrenics, achievers, people on the spiritual journey, hopeful, frustrated, despairing, responsible, laid back. That's all channel two. That's as the world turns. It goes on and on and on and on. It's personality, and everybody loves it. In this culture, we worship personality. It's thick and real and solid, and we play with it. It's only channel two. Channel three. It's what Jung calls archetypes. It's the mythic identities. It's I'm an Aries and you're a Sagittarius. It's that one. It's all of the bigger than life, individual different stuff. Oh, I know, you're in search of the Holy Grail and you're, what do you expect from a Libra? You know? It's that one. Flip one more channel. I look out and I see fellow souls. I look in your eyes and I see behind all the individual differences, I see another soul just like mine. It's still different, it's still separate, but it's another soul. You in there? I'm in here. How'd you get into that one? And at that moment, you see the body and the personality and the archetypes and all that stuff as the packaging of a soul. And then you understand the nature of karma. Because you come and you enter into this package of all this stuff, and this package determines how you see the world, how people see you, and thus the nature of the experiences you have all the way through. And that's, so you are a karmic happening in terms of individual differences. And one more channel, and there's only one thing looking at itself, looking at itself, looking at itself. There's only one of it. That's the awareness one. Even to call it one is a hype. That's, you see that from the two. Once you're in it, there's nothing. Or everything, whatever you want to call it. Now, what do you give your child? Channel one and two? If channel one and two is all you got, that's what you give. And that's the reality you keep reinforcing for your child. If you have that other space, like when I go in and see somebody that is dying of AIDS, the question is, who do I see? Who am I with? What space does my mind as the environment for that person at that moment offer? And you find out, like in the Bhagavad Gita, it says, a fortunate child is born in a family of yogis. Doesn't mean so that you can have an agile body. It means that you're born into consciousness that you're surrounded by that has spaciousness in it, so you don't lose your connection to all of it. Because the predicament is, most of us got socialized so zealously by everybody that socialized us that we got caught in our separateness and we lost the way we're not separate. And so your work on yourself is to see that you fulfill the role as mother, as wife, as nurturer, as this, as that, and also you're not caught in it. That you're just spacious awareness. And you're that around your child, and then your child has a resonance to that part of herself that is just spacious awareness. And then as she grows older, she can handle the changing world because she has this other resource in her, because there was a resonance in her childhood that allowed her to recognize and keep connected to that. Okay? It's a good one, isn't it? Yeah. Sir. He's saying that it's not just an attitude. that you can lay a trip when you go out into somebody that's sick, for example, to see their soul or to see beyond the soul. It's something you've had to cultivate and develop and work in order to be it, not to just have an attitude about it or just to have a thought about it. Is that what you're saying? Yeah, sure. Absolutely. But the first thing to have is the view of where you're going. Then you start to work with it. For example, when I go in, like I have a friend, I have a friend who's a quadriplegic. And when he was 9, he got hit in the side of the head, and he's 33 now, and he can't do anything. I mean, he can barely swallow, and he can't speak. He's in a wheelchair. And you can hold, his attendants can hold his hand over an alphabet board, and he can spell out letter by letter what he wants to say. And he's extremely wonderful, creative, bright, warm, good human being. We've been working together for 10 years now. When I first met him, he was very angry. And when I first met him, I was so overwhelmed by the symbolic value of his illness, of his what he had lost or what he didn't have, that it took me almost 6 months of being with him, like once every couple of weeks, before I could get through the power of the reactivity of my mind, even though I had a belief system that he was in there and I was in here. It took me a long time to get through the reactivity to the thing of I'm glad I'm not that, and then guilty for feeling all that stuff, until finally he and I could just be together, which we have been for years now. You in there? We don't even say it. I mean, it's just we meet. And he's got his storyline and I've got my storyline. But at first, it was a theoretical belief, and it took a long time of working in that situation until it came through to just being that. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah. It's a deep one. This is a story, again, many of these are stories I've shared with many of you in Boston or in tapes, you know. But a few years ago, I think it's 3 or 4 or 5 years ago now, I was teaching a course in New York at St. John the Divine for people working with homeless and getting people to go out and do volunteer work and stuff. We had an open microphone, and one woman said, she said, every day I leave my apartment and I go to work and I go by the corner of the street, and for the past 8 months there has been a man standing on the corner with a paper cup with some coins in it. She said, he's our local homeless person. And she said, he's been there a long time and I've worked out. She said, I give him some money every now and then. And then she kind of smiled and she was a little sheepish and she said, I've worked out a budget actually. She said, $250 a week, and I just sort of spread it around the way I give it to him. And she said, but as a result of taking this course, I realized that though I've been giving him money, saying hello, I have never really acknowledged his existence as a human being. And she said, I thought about that, and I realized I was frightened. She said, I said, what am I frightened of? She said, I'm not frightened he's going to rape me or steal my pocketbook. I mean, I've known him for 8 months. We've been around. She said, when I examined it, she said, I was afraid that if I opened my heart to him, he'd end up in my living room. She was afraid that she couldn't define boundaries. So the fear, the emotional feeling tone, which she couldn't acknowledge because she was busy in categories which were denial techniques. The mind is used for denial of the feeling tone, and the feeling tone is divisive as well. And part of learning how, what I talk about in my work with people, is learning how to keep your heart open in hell. Learning how to deal with your breaking heart all the time as you're dealing with the stuff of life. And still be rooted in that awareness that lies just behind that, or within that, within it, behind it. And that balance is what allows you to keep right out on the front edge all the time with your emotional pain, rather than getting caught in reactivity to your emotional pain. Well, it would be joyous. Believe me, it would be joyous for me too. I thought a while back, you know, I'm getting along, and the body isn't going to be able to move around like this forever. Wouldn't television be nice? Because I could, I mean, if I do a tour of 60 cities, at the maximum, probably I talk to about maybe 120,000 people. And one spot on a television show is like 10 million people or something. I mean, why not use, why? It's like learning to use a computer. Why should I be so frightened of the media? So I started to say, all right, I'm going to take on the media. And I'm going to start to work with the media because it's a beautiful vehicle. It isn't there's anything so corrupt about the medium. It's the corruption is who uses it for what purpose, okay? So I came at it with a beautiful mindset. But what I found was that because the medium is so powerful in the fact that it is so influential of human consciousness in the culture, it is very carefully guarded as to how it's used. And that it is not available for the kinds of consciousness that raises questions about the basic social institutions themselves. And in addition to that, the way the game has been played, because it is such a power domain, there's so much power connected with it, that the economics of it are way, way out of proportion to its the need for that economically. For example, the SEVA Foundation that I'm on the board of, we work in Nepal, India. There are 50,000 blind that see every year as a result of our work. There are Guatemalans that live that would die. There's American Indians that have health service. There's all kinds of wonderful projects that have been going on for years. Our whole cash budget is about $1.2 million, and then we have about $2 million of in-kind stuff, but $1.2 million in cash. I set out 4 years ago to prepare a television special for PBS of 3 hours long. The cost of that when we finish will be roughly $1,200,000. Same budget as the SEVA budget. Now I have a hell of a hard time justifying that kind of money investment to raise $1,200,000 to put out a 3-hour television show. That's hard for me. When I think of how many blind could see, you know, now I can say, well, it's going into the economy, it's all wonderful. But that's one of the obstacles to the game. And what happens is, when it costs that much, it's very hard to create the same kind of energy space as it does when it doesn't cost that much. And that's interesting. So for me to, I've got it, it got in the can. I did a 10-week program for 1,000 people in Oakland, California, with all kinds of people like Peter Gabriel and Arlo Guthrie and the Zulu Spare and the choirs and all kinds of stuff, Bobby McFerrin and all kinds of people, and plus these beautiful beings and lectures and group dynamics and following people out in the community, a four-camera shoot. I mean, we've got hundreds of hours of exquisite stuff. That cost only $650,000 to get it in the can. It's now costing $400,000 or $500,000 to get it edited. And I interviewed 21 people around the country, the head of Rotary International. I interviewed, ecologists, political figures, all kinds of incredible people. The Dalai Lama in Tibet, I mean, in Dharamsala, I interviewed them all, brought cameras, I mean, a lot of money and all that stuff. Now I'm doing the editing, or the groups are doing the editing, another $400,000 or $500,000 to do the editing. And maybe in a year or two, because I decided to see this one through to its conclusion, you will see that. And maybe it'll catch, and maybe then instead of Bradshaw, you'll get Ram Dass. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, it's went sequence Leo Buscaglia, Bradshaw, Ram Dass. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe I'll be too old by then or something. But it's hard. It is hard. It's hard emotionally. It's hard on every single level. And I did it this way because I wanted to keep control of the content and the quality. When I first thought of doing it, I went to see Norman Lear, and I went to see the people that do all the Moyers stuff in New York, and I said, here I am, let's go. And they said, well, it's fine, but we'll just change you a little bit into this, and this, and this, and this. And I realized that what they would do, they would homogenize it. They'd turn it into something that didn't change, that didn't, you know, because I'm saying a lot of stuff in this discussion today that's heresy. And a company doesn't pay for the heresy that's going to undercut the values on which it exists. It's not going to do it. It's even PBS. They're fools to do it. So that's part of the, it's a long-term answer, winded answer to that question. Yes. Yes. Sure. I mean, the question is, how could the society that is experiencing the pain it's in not want to examine solutions? How could it not want? How could, but you see, you just see, you can see how when there is power, worldly power, there is vested interest in preserving the power, and the vested interest is in not upsetting the apple cart. And so you see more and more massive levels of denial. Nobody's willing to bite the bullet. Nobody's willing to come out and just play and say, here we are, because we may have to give up something. We may have to give up something. And we don't quite want to do that. And so when you say, as you develop and experience as we're doing, the pain of our predicament, and then how do you deal with the mass consciousness that has so much major denial in it? That's exactly what we're asking ourselves today. Where can we stand in ourselves so that we can contribute to something that doesn't exacerbate suffering but is healing without getting burned out in our efforts to do it, without getting destroyed by it? Yeah. You just took it in another direction, but that's fine too. We'll end with this and then have lunch. She said... Simplified, she said, look, I'm out there trying to do stuff and trying to work on myself while I'm out there trying to help the world change and all. But now I find myself drawn to a practice, a very heartful practice, but it's a practice that has a great a sense of its own uniqueness and importance. And it says it's important that I must do this over all other things, really. I mean, this is the important practice I must do. And it separates me from, I mean, that's what you're saying, it separates you. And she doesn't feel want. She doesn't want to be separate. She loves the practice, but she's a universalist. Okay, yeah. Now, the predicament is that you've got, the key image is that for methods to work, that here are the three lines. All methods are traps. Okay, first thing, hear it. All methods are traps. For a method to work, you have to be trapped. Yeah. If the method is a liberating method, it will then self-destruct. Wait a minute. Just let me finish this again. So, you start out loving everything. You get drawn to a method. You start to go towards the method, but you realize that the method is going to scrunch you in. and you say, but you feel the intuitive pull of the method. You go in, you get scrunched, you may even get fanatic during that time. It's the only way, you know, like Christian fundamentalism. It's the only way. Christ is the only way. And then, if you're lucky, and you joined a method, and you come into it with a pure heart, when you get into it fully, you see through it, and you're beyond it. And you don't end up a meditator. Like, the horror thing is meeting people. How are you? My name's Ramdas. I'm a meditator. How do you do, meditator? I've been meditating for 30 years. I'm a meditator. The game is to get free, not be a meditator, see? But people are meditators, or they're Christians, or they're Jews, or they're this, or they're that. And those are stages. There are stages of where you have to use the definition in order to fulfill, to get deep enough into the practice to make it work. And then if it works, it takes you beyond the practice. And you've got to trust that. It's scary, but you've got to trust it. Let's just do one simple little chant just to get our hearts back here. This has thirds in it, and it's very simple. It has the word God, so if you have trouble with that, what should you do about that? Think of your pussycat or something. Think of something you love when we use the word God, because it's just a shorthand for what is beyond form anyway. There is no name to what it is, so it's always just a finger pointing at the moon. This is very simple. It's just two lines. Praise God for the light within us. Praise God, let love abide. And you do it in thirds above, so I'll show you. Praise God for the light within us. Praise God, let love abide. Let's get that first. Praise God for the light within us. Praise God, let love abide. And the third is, praise God for the light within us. Praise God, let love abide. Praise God for the light within us. Praise God, let love abide. So we'll start with the low one, and then you can add the other one as you feel like it, and just go in and feel, do it from a place in the middle of the chest, very softly, and think about it. Feel about it. Feel about it. Don't think about it. Praise God for the light within us. Praise God, let love abide. Praise God for the light within us. Praise God, let love. last time.